Another Black American dead after a routine traffic stop. Why Dante Wright is just the latest name we know that follows this disturbing pattern. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, April 15th, we're talking about how traffic stops sometimes end in tragedy. And we're continuing our coverage of the case of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer charged in the killing of George Floyd. Also on the show, President Joe Biden has officially announced plans to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, ending the U.S.'s longest ever war.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
Headlines up first, then you're back with me on The Takeaway. See you then. Another Black American.
WMNF 10. This is a special edition of The Takeaway.
On their greatest behavior, their best behavior, it should be now.
Another traffic stop, another Black American dead. This time, the victim was 20-year-old Dante Wright, who was shot and killed by a veteran officer on the Brooklyn Center Police Force in Minnesota on Sunday. Wright is just the latest example of a Black driver who didn't make it out alive after being pulled over for what was supposed to be a routine traffic stop. Philando Castile and Terrence Crutcher are two other high-profile cases of Black people who've been killed in police traffic stops over the past few years. Racial profiling is a big reason for many of these stops. Today, Black drivers are 20% more likely to be pulled over than white drivers, and Black drivers are also more likely to be ticketed than white drivers. And wealth isn't a deterrent for these stops either. In 2016, after the killing of Philando Castile, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott revealed that he had been pulled over 7 times in the course of 1 year. And even when these incidents don't end in death, they can still be moments of extreme trauma and stress.
Work with us and we'll talk to you. Get out the car.
You received our order. Obey it.
I'm honestly afraid to get out. Can I?
Yeah, you should be. Get out.
What?
Get out.
Consider Army Second Lieutenant Colin Nazario, a Black Latino man in uniform who in December was pulled over by police with their guns drawn and pepper sprayed. I'm Tanzina Vega, and examining why driving while Black is so dangerous in this country is where we begin today on The Takeaway. Rashad Robinson is president of Color of Change, and he joins me now. Rashad, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Rashad, what do we know about the traffic stop that Dante Wright experienced before he was killed?
Well, what we know is that it's kind of typical. It's par for the course of what we see time and time again. Someone being pulled over in a way that's deeply profiled, a Black person being pulled away in a way that's deeply profiled, that the police move in on a Black suspect in a way that they would never move in on a white suspect. And then what doesn't always happen, but what happens far too often, is that we now end up with someone that has been hurt, harmed, or killed, and in this case, killed. And then we end up with police department trying to figure out a story and closing ranks to protect themselves. Time and time again, when we see these incidents happen, we end up with a situation where police refuse to take any accountability for the structural challenges and the structural rules, both written and unwritten, that actually incentivize the killing of Black people by police in this country, and a system that far too often overwhelmingly denies any type of accountability to the families or the community.
Let's talk about, you say that this is a structural issue, and I kind of want to understand that, because part of what we're thinking about in doing this segment is thinking about the incidents that we know of, the Philando Castile killing, the Dante Wright killing, the Terrence Crutcher killing. All of these happened in what were supposed to be routine traffic stops. And I'm wondering, what is the calculus that turns a traffic stop into a killing?
Well, part of the calculus is what we know about police culture. Police culture, which is deeply, deeply racist. And I know that this may sound maybe hyperbolic to some of your listeners, or you know that I'm sort of just throwing things out there. But in 2015, the FBI actually came out with a report talking about the infiltration of white nationalism and the racism inside of policing in this country. We also deal with a policing culture that actually fails to really ever admit to racial profiling existing. And I say this as someone that has sat in meetings during the Obama White House. And I remember a meeting back in 2016 with about 30 folks in the room. It was advocates like myself. It was mayors and other elected officials. And it was those in law enforcement. And the head of the Fraternal Order of Police responded to me in public in front of President Obama, in front of elected officials and police chiefs. When I started talking about racial profiling, he interrupted me. This is Joe Pasco, and said, all of this talk of racial profiling is new to me. Now, it would be one thing for him to say, I don't agree that you're, you know, about your demands around what to do. I don't think that it's happening as much. But he gaslit the very idea that racial profiling exists. So what we have on one hand is widespread racial profiling happening. You tick through some of the numbers in the opening. And then you end up with a policing culture that actually fails to admit that it doesn't exist. And then what we get is politicians who say, oh, we just need more training. Well, this police officer was actually a leader of the training this police officer was one of the leaders of the training, and she couldn't even figure out the difference between her taser and her gun. And she was one of the trainers. And this is what we end up with, is we end up with kind of garbage in and garbage out as it relates to the type of cutting around the edges that end up happening when these incidents happening, rather than actually going to the structures. And structurally, policing in this country has been and is about control. And when you are focused on control and not focused on safety, you end up killing people for no reason, because who was in danger during that traffic stop? The only person that was in danger was Dante Wright, and Dante Wright is no longer with us now. The police officer pulled out a gun instead of pulling out a taser, and we should make no mistake. Tasers are also deeply dangerous. They are not safe devices. And far too often, tasers get pulled on black people and used on black people as well.
Let's talk a little bit about some of this, because we do have data about the fact that black drivers are 20% more likely to be stopped by police than white drivers are. We also know that police departments across the country, I mean, this was something, you know, almost a decade ago now that was being talked about, if not longer, about how to implement implicit bias training so that these incidences do not happen. And yet here we are. Rashad, what do we know about how much of this supposed implicit bias training has been implemented across the country?
There is definitely implicit bias training happening in different places. And what we know is at the end of the day, it doesn't actually lead to better outcomes at a macro level. If we don't deal with downsizing policing, if we don't deal with actually putting in accountability structures that really have teeth to them. So right now, police officers, unlike so many other professions, cannot be held civilly accountable for what they do on the job, right? And so what we end up with is this situation called qualified immunity, where police officers are not held accountable. We watch as police unions have created a whole set of rules and structures, whether it's how they elect prosecutors and put mayors into office, over $50 million injected into elections since 2012 to leverage their power to dictate the terms of elections. And then what we also see, you know, when it relates to the sort of way in which policing works, is that we send police to do things that they shouldn't be doing. So we send police to go deal with someone who's passed a bad check. We send someone with a gun to go deal with someone that's having a mental health episode. So policing has also become this thing that we send in all situations. And that also has to stop. But police are not held accountable. And so because we have this structure of lack of accountability, you can't actually train racism away. And you can't actually do implicit bias when someone is given a gun and someone is given carte blanche power to be able to do whatever they want to do.
Excuse me, Rashad. What do drivers, particularly black drivers, need to be aware of when it comes to their rights if they're pulled over by police? Let's tackle that.
So this is a really important question. It's the type of conversations that, you know, people have, you know, adults are having with the young people in their lives, parents are having with their children. And this is, becomes really hard as we increasingly see these videos where black people are following the rules, you know, putting their hands on the steering wheel, trying to talk slowly. You have an officer in a military man in a uniform who is, you know, trying to be in conversation with the police and is still being sort of tased. You have all of these situations happening. But yes, we do have rights. But I think it's important to recognize that there's written rules and there's unwritten rules. And what we, you know, tell the young people in our lives is keep your hands on the steering wheel. Don't make any sudden moves. You know, speak slowly and clearly. Do your best to follow the directions of the officer and try to get out of the situation alive. But that is, unfortunately, those set of rules can oftentimes be thrown out at any given moment, because what we end up with is police officers that are not playing by any set of rules and have no set of accountability in. And until we actually pass laws that hold police officers accountable, and until our system actually does this, we will continue to have black people that are killed violently by police on camera, and then no accountability is done. And that does not produce safety, it does not produce justice, and it does not actually make any of us better in our society.
Rashad Robinson is the president of Color of Change. Rashad, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been hearing from our listeners on this as well. We asked if you've ever been pulled over by police. What were your feelings about your personal safety?
My name is Rashid, and I moved to the U.S. when I was 12 years old. And it's crazy hearing about all these traffic stops and the calamities that can come out of it, because this wasn't something that I knew was a thing when I moved here. As a black man myself, I find that I have to drive super carefully just to avoid traffic stops. And I do everything in my power just to maximize my survival.
Hi, my name's Ginger Graham, and I'm from Columbia, South Carolina. As a black woman living in South Carolina, I have learned that it's in my best interest to always keep silent in the event that, you know, I have the need to express some grievance or issue whenever I've been pulled over. It's sad that I have to feel this way, especially in 2021, but it's just a fact. However, whenever that court date or that court appearance comes along, it's game on at that point.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
And Atlassian. Fortune 500 companies use collaboration software like Jira and Trello from Atlassian, enabling teams to keep aligned to key goals and connected to one another. That's how businesses the size of small countries stay agile. Learn more at Atlassian.com.
This is a takeaway from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Today we check back in on the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer accused of killing George Floyd last May. This week the defense began presenting its case, but first we heard from George Floyd's brother, who gave some emotional testimony.
Sir, would you please describe this photo and what you know about it?
That's my oldest brother, George. And May 24th, I got married. And my brother was killed May 25th. And my mom died on May 30th. So it's like a bittersweet month because I'm supposed to be happy when that month comes.
Here to walk us through the latest in the trial is John Collins, class and criminal justice reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. John, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So all of this is happening in the shadow of the Dante Wright protests over in Brooklyn Center. The defense case here for Chauvin began putting forward its case this week, but they asked the judge on Monday to sequester the jury because of the protests. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the jurors in this case are already partly sequestered, which means they drive to a secure location and then are escorted into the government center by sheriff's deputies. But defense attorney Eric Nelson asked the judge on Monday to sequester jurors completely, which means, you know, to put them up in a hotel to help them avoid publicity. But the judge said that maybe some of the jurors did hear about what happened to Dante Wright, but it's a different case with different facts. So he said it's not necessary to sequester them completely at this point. But in any case, once jury deliberations actually start, which could be as early as this coming Monday, they will be fully sequestered in a hotel.
Let's talk a little bit about what we heard from George Floyd's brother earlier at the top of the segment here. What did his testimony put forward?
Yeah, Philomas Floyd, he testified to what's called Spark of Life testimony, which is kind of a unique thing to Minnesota. It allows emotional testimony from loved ones about who the victim actually was. And, you know, he talked about growing up with George Floyd. He talked about how George Floyd kind of mentored him in sports and how George Floyd loved basketball and football. And, you know, he, at one point he mentioned how George Floyd made the best banana and mayonnaise sandwiches, even though he couldn't really cook. So he kind of gave jurors a different perspective of Floyd than they've likely gotten from watching most of the body camera footage of his final moments of life and his killing.
We also started hearing from the defense with its case this week, and they began by looking at a 2019 arrest of George Floyd. What we know here that the defense has largely focused on Mr. Floyd's previous drug use and other things that might not have anything to do with this case directly, and they seem to be continuing on that. What are they trying to prove with this 2019 arrest of Mr. Floyd?
One of the things that they wanted to get across to jurors that the judge has restricted them in being able to explicitly say is to the idea that George Floyd has a history of trying to eat drugs in order to avoid arrest. And so that's what they were trying to get at in that 2019 case, and by bringing it up and going through the facts of it.
I'm just curious, though, about that defense, because at the end of the day, the case is not about whether Mr. Floyd was consuming drugs. The case is whether or not former police officer Derek Chauvin killed Mr. Floyd.
That's right. Well, one of their defense arguments, though, is that Floyd died due to drugs in his system. They've implied maybe an overdose, in that played a role along with, you know, heart disease and things like that. So what they're trying to do is just introduce reasonable doubt to the jurors that the prosecution arguments there that Floyd actually died because Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, and he was restrained by two other officers in a prone position. They're trying to poke holes in that and make jurors doubt.
And they're also bringing up different experts here, the defense, to sort of poke holes in the argument that then Officer Chauvin used appropriate use of force, which the prosecution has obviously different opinions on. What do we know so far about that argument?
Yeah, so, I mean, the prosecution introduced a number of use of force experts, so much that you could see some jurors by the end of the testimony start to get exhausted. One person started even like dozing off a tiny bit, which you certainly don't want. But they introduced lots of use of force experts and Minneapolis police chief Madeira Arredondo, who said this isn't the way that Minneapolis cops are trained, and then also that on a national scale, this is not at all how police officers are trained in modern training. So the defense tried to counter that with their own use of force expert, who did argue that it was an appropriate use of force. And he actually even said keeping someone in the prone position on the ground, he didn't even consider a use of force. But under cross-examination by the prosecution, they were able to kind of undermine some of his points and arguments. So it really depends on how the jurors are going to take this. And we may hear more from those use of force experts for the defense.
John, what can we expect? Can we expect Chauvin himself to take the stand?
You know, that's an open question. At this point, we haven't heard. But obviously, a defendant always does have the right to take the stand in their own name. It's a legal question of, you know, do they benefit from putting him on the stand, or does it even do his case even more harm?
John Collins is a class and criminal justice reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Throughout the week, we ask our listener response network a question of the day, and their responses and voices become our program. Join them by texting the word START to 70101. Again, that's START to 70101. You'll be subscribed to our listener question and can weigh in on issues you care about. Standard messaging and data rates apply. The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a program that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
To the Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. On Wednesday, President Joe Biden formally announced his plans to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
The decision would mark the end of the U.S.'s longest ever war, and already it has lawmakers split in Washington over what this could mean on the ground in Afghanistan down the line. I'm joined now by Robin Wright, columnist at The New Yorker and Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow. Robin, great to have you back.
Great to be with you.
We heard President Biden say he doesn't want to leave a fifth president to deal with this. What do we know was behind that decision? Was it his altruism to not leave this for another president, or was it something else?
Joe Biden has wanted to get out of Afghanistan for more than a decade. He opposed the surge that President Obama had ordered in Afghanistan to try to push the Taliban back. So this has been his approach all along. But he also inherited the deal that President Trump made between United States and the Taliban, that pledge that the U.S. would be out on May 1st. So Joe Biden had to make a decision about whether to try to keep troops there a little bit longer while the Afghan government and the Taliban continue to negotiate over a future government, or to decide that the United States has given enough time to both parties to work this out, and that since there's no military solution, that it was time to hand over to the Afghans themselves.
You mentioned what President Obama's plans were in Afghanistan. Remind us, President Trump also made efforts to end this long war that we've been in. Remind us what his efforts were.
Well, President Trump tried very hard to bring all American forces back from both the Middle East and South Asia. And the deal with the Taliban was the main agreement that to come out of this. He also had brought home, you know, thousands of troops and ordered, when you think about what we had at the height of our presence in Afghanistan, over 100,000 forces. And when Joe Biden took over, there were only 2,500. Now there are a few more because there's some special forces folks there. And it varies a little bit in terms of the total, but we're down to, you know, something like 2% of what we had at our peak. So the drawdown was already in force, well in force, under the Trump administration. And now it will be done, I suspect, long before September 11th, although that's the final date.
Would this apply to all troops? How many troops are still in the country? And then does this include contractors and other folks, or just specific to troops?
The United States has its, you know, somewhere between 2,500 and 3,500 troops. NATO has more than 7,000 troops, so it's a much larger force than the United States. And then there are over 20,000 contractors who are vital in sustaining the Afghan military, particularly the Air Force, which is the one thing the Taliban doesn't have is air power. So the Air Force for the Afghan government is critical. NATO announced that it, too, will be drawing down with the United States, pulling out completely. The question really is, what happens to the contractors? Will companies, private companies, be willing to continue to deploy? Are there liability issues? Who's going to pay their contracts? And, of course, what role will the United States and its allies play in supporting the government and making sure that the government is capable of paying its salaries? As it is, the United States pays a huge percentage of the salaries of the Afghan military, and there are indications that it will continue to do so. But that doesn't mean that it's going to beat the Taliban, because the Taliban now controls at least 50% of the country.
We're going to be back with more on what troop withdrawals will mean for Afghanistan. Stick with us. Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega, and we've been talking about President Biden's plans to withdraw troops from Afghanistan by September 11th. I'm joined by Robin Wright, columnist at The New Yorker and Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow. Robin, what will the withdrawal of troops mean for the Afghan people? How will this affect their lives?
In enormous ways, I think, particularly those who feel that the Western intervention led by the United States had helped develop, whether it was new universities, a civil society, promote women's rights in education, the workplace, and in government. There will be many people who feel betrayed, that the United States is walking away from them. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Kabul today and tried to signal that the U.S. is not abandoning Afghanistan, as it did after the Soviet withdrawal. People forget that the U.S. spent billions to support militias that fought the Soviet Union. In the aftermath of that, the U.S. was unprepared to provide even $1 million to help with education. Blinken is trying to signal that the United States will continue to be involved, that continue to be an important ally. I'm not sure that will really happen in reality. The focus is increasingly on Asia, particularly China. Whether there will be the resources in this, you know, critical time in our history with a pandemic and all the obligations at home, will be a real question whether Afghan gets what Afghans think they deserve. And I suspect there will be a brain drain. Many people will want to leave Afghanistan because they fear the return of the Taliban as its government.
There are many different perspectives on this pullout in Washington. What can you tell us, Robin, about how much support there is right now for this effort?
I think the polls indicate that the American people support the withdrawal of American forces after 20 years. There's a sense that Afghanistan may not ever have been winnable militarily. In terms of Joe Biden's legacy, he will probably be looked at by some as either the president who is finally extricating America from the quagmires in the messy Middle East or messy South Asia. But he also may be viewed by historians as the president who opened the way for the Taliban to return to either some major government role or even taking over the government. So history may take a different judgment than the American people do today.
What happens next? How do you even begin a process like withdrawal of troops at this level?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to remember is there is still a peace process that the U.S. is trying to support to get the warring parties together. It was supposed to take place in Istanbul later this month. The question is now, will the Taliban even bother to go knowing that the U.S. is indeed going to leave? Will it feel it has the leverage to just sit it out? But in terms of the logistics of withdrawal, the U.S. will begin a phased withdrawal of equipment and men. I suspect by this summer, they will all be out well before September 11th, but that will be the symbolic moment when the U.S. can say, we're out, the NATO is out, we turn security responsibilities back to the Afghan government.
We've also spent an enormous amount of money on this war, Robin. Are those resources and those dollars going to be reallocated towards more defense spending, or do we even know what's going to happen there?
The United States has spent more than $1 trillion. It's our longest war, and it may be one of our very most expensive. The United States has pledged to continue to aid Afghanistan, but it will be in much smaller amounts. I think the reallocation of resources will focus heavily on other parts of Asia, and as the president said in his announcement, on the extremist movements that have proliferated. So it's not just in Afghanistan or the Middle East anymore. It's in North Africa, even Southern Africa, far across is Indonesia, in East Asia. And the focus will be in developing counterterrorism forces that can deal with the proliferation of extremist and jihadi threats around the world.
Robin Wright is a columnist at The New Yorker and Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow. Robin, thanks so much, as always, for your reporting.
Thank you, Tanzina.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Last week, a six-hour documentary on the writer Ernest Hemingway premiered on PBS. The film is the latest production from Ken Burns, the filmmaker whose decades-long relationship with public broadcasting has yielded hundreds of hours of documentary films on topics from baseball to jazz to the Vietnam War. But Burns' influence at PBS and his domination of the documentary film world is something that filmmakers of color are taking issue with. In February, director and producer Grace Lee wrote an essay saying that PBS's long-standing reliance on Burns, a white male filmmaker, has called into question the mission of the network, which was founded in part to provide diverse content for viewers nationwide. And while PBS president and CEO Paula Kerger told reporters that she, quote, respectfully disagrees with a number of the points made in Lee's essay, more filmmakers of color have been speaking out. In an open letter to Kerger at the end of March, a group called Beyond Inclusion published a letter signed by more than 600 members of the documentary industry calling for more transparency and diversity from PBS. I'm joined now by two of the members of Beyond Inclusion. Po C. Tang is the director for the International Documentary Association Funds and producer of the documentary St. Louis Superman. Po, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
And Michelle Stevenson is the co-founder of the Brooklyn-based production company Rada Studio. She's also co-director of the documentaries American Promise and series producer of PBS's American Portrait. Great to have you with us, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having us.
Start with you, Michelle. Tell us a little bit about why you decided collectively to publish this open letter to PBS.
Well, I can start a little bit further back. We came together as a collective as, I think, a coming out of the uprisings of 2020. All of us were connected to certain advocacy groups that represented some of our communities, from the Black Documentary Collective that's been around since St. Clair Bourne, who passed away many years ago, to the Black Brown Girls Doc Mafia and the Asian Doc Alliance. And so we decided to come together across our identities to kind of discuss ways that we could improve sort of the ecosystem and landscape. And what came out of Grace Lee's letter, she was part of the collective. The article she first wrote, we were very supportive of it. But what really led us to sort of react had to do with sort of the defensive nature in which the response from PBS came out. And we realized that we needed to act. And so the open letter is a result of kind of our own questioning, not of just of our practices, but of questioning of our own relationship with an entity, a public entity that is mission-driven, that's not market-driven, that's not algorithmic-driven, but whose driven mission is a diversity of perspectives. So we felt, even many of us have produced and directed for PBS, felt that it was really our responsibility and even our obligation to challenge and to question. So that's where we are now.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Michelle, because we have a bunch of questions we want to get to. Po, in response to some of the letter, there were a number of, PBS issued a statement saying in part that this year alone, and I'm quoting here from their statement, we are airing more than 200 primetime hours of documentary, and 55% of those hours feature BIPOC talent. But for those who don't know that acronym, it means Black, Indigenous, and People of Color, are produced by diverse filmmakers or cover topics related to diversity. Of the 200 hours, 35% are produced by diverse filmmakers. Po, your take on PBS's response?
You know, those numbers, those figures, they're so broad. What do they actually mean? I mean, of those hours and those percentages, are those figures really being attributed to the key creators of these projects? What is PBS actually trying to say? And what our group Beyond Inclusion is asking, and what the public wants to know, and filmmakers of color wants to know, and our allies wants to know, is what about the directors and the producers? What is the percentages of BIPOC talent there?
So, I mean, do we know? I mean, they're saying that 35% are produced by diverse filmmakers. Is that an increase? Is that something that you guys think is enough? Or are you looking for more specifics in terms of executive producer roles?
You know, I think it's very important to have more specific figures. You know, Paula Kerger, in her letter, she actually responded to the public letter that we wrote. She talks about the urgency to amplify diverse voices and diverse perspectives, which is really wonderful. But really, where we need to start is to have specific figures. Blanket numbers, I mean, one could cherry pick figures and say, oh, you know, X percent is made by BIPOC talent. But what does that actually mean? Is PBS counting assistants? I mean, we know for a fact when numbers are quoted or pulled out, it could encompass all sorts of folks working in film. So specificity is very important, because then it actually really, really shows like who is really getting the funds and be able to shape some of these docs on public television.
Well, I'm going to have to go with that, with the numbers that they have here. I'm just curious, before we break for this next segment, Michelle, did you feel you were taking a risk in signing this letter to PBS? Because you do work with PBS as well.
I work with PBS, but my work doesn't depend on PBS. And that's what many of independent filmmakers, BIPOC filmmakers, struggle with in terms of balancing keeping our independence and keeping the channels open. So I can pay for my lights without necessarily having to depend on having my strand or my projects done. But I did want to address something very quickly. It's about the funds. It's about unpacking those numbers where some strands bear the brunt of representation, from the POVs to the independent lenses to the World Channel, where the funding is not equitable. And that's where we are, and some might say, overrepresented, right? So it's about the numbers, how they're allocated, which strands get the voices, and what does that mean?
We're going to have to pause here and take a break, but we'll have more on filmmakers of color calling for PBS to improve its commitment to diversity in just a moment. This is The Takeaway. With you on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. We've been speaking about growing calls for PBS to support more documentary makers of color. Last month, a group called Beyond Inclusion published an open letter demanding more transparency and equity from PBS. With me now are filmmakers Posey Tang and Michelle Stevenson, two of the members of Beyond Inclusion. Po, I wanted to, you know, we've been talking about PBS, but how dominant are they in the documentary landscape?
PBS is a public broadcaster, so you know they've always been supporting independent filmmakers. So I would say pretty dominant, but of course they're only a part of the entire share of the documentary pie. I mean, you have streamers, you have platforms, you have studios. So each of these divisions sort of take a segment of the pie, but PBS is significant in that, you know, it is for public good and is supported by taxpayer funds.
Which is very different than, say, Netflix, right?
Absolutely.
Do those platforms, Poe, represent an opportunity? I mean, mission statements aside, and I completely understand the argument here that PBS's mission is also to, you know, serve the public. But in terms of opportunities for diverse filmmakers and documentarians, are there more opportunities in these streaming services than there might be at a place like PBS?
I would say yes and no. I mean, so much of it, be it in PBS or, you know, Netflix, Hulu, and the like, these streamers, it all ultimately, whether or not filmmakers of color get an opportunity to make their films, it comes down to the top level executives and what they see as valuable for their either on public broadcast or on these streaming platforms.
Michelle, I want to play some sound from Ken Burns, sir, from 2021 at the Yahoo Finance interview that he did, to sort of talk a little bit about how he gets his films funded and how he works with PBS. Let's take a listen.
I've been with public television my entire thing. I'm staying with them. They have one foot in the marketplace and the other tentatively out. Look, I could have gone a few years ago or 10, 13 years ago to a streaming channel or a premium cable and say, I need, with my track record, I need $30 million to do Vietnam. And they would have given it me. But what they wouldn't have given me is 10 and a half years. PBS gave me 10 and a half years. And they gave me 6.5 on Ernest Hemingway and 10 on National Parks.
Michelle, your take on that, because very few creators at all are often given $30 million in 10 and a half years.
I don't even know where to start. I mean, that is such an obvious statement of white male privilege that not many of us who signed, now there are over 600 of the signatories to the open letter, could even lay claim to. And I take issue with one foot in the marketplace and one foot outside of the marketplace. My tax dollars don't go to the marketplace as a viewer, as an audience, and as a maker. So as a first, right? I challenge it. It is an obvious sort of demonstration of privilege without questioning of what that means, what space that takes versus other people, but also spending some of that time telling the stories of our communities. And we have to question that also. How do we diversify who gets to tell what stories in a space that is limited in terms of airtime and hours? And that's what we're also asking PBS. Give us what the hours breakdowns are so we can better understand what we are up against.
Michelle, PBS has cited its work with black producers, including with Henry Louis Gates and Stanley Nelson, as evidence of their commitment to diversity, particularly in the documentary space. What's your response to that?
It's not enough for us to rely on those numbers or rely on that presence to respond to the mission again. And a very telling point is Stanley himself has signed. Sam Pollard, who's also a PBS contributor, has signed. So it means that there is a reckoning. And we are now, you know, in a pandemic post-uprising again moment where, you know, our lives are really on the line. It is time to question not just ourselves, because I think this whole year has been also about questioning personally my own practice. We need to also ask of those who work with us to do better and to do better in a much deeper way. So it's not just diversity inclusion as a goal, but diversity inclusion as being a tool towards greater justice and equity. So, and I do it as someone who loves PBS. I've spoken many times as a child. I learned how to speak English.
This has been a special broadcast of The Takeaway. Stay tuned for Midpoint Thursday, hosted by Janet Scherberger and Shelley Reebok, following NPR News. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting WMNF Tampa, your community conscious radio station.